To begin with, I would say that the research that I've been involved with for about 12 years, largely in collaboration with George Gerbner at the Annenberg School, has focused primarily on television as what we have talked about as the mainstream of American culture. And I think with reference to the issues we've just been discussing, we've just been seeing, that network television, prime time network drama, in many ways is different than the stuff we've just been seeing, which is certainly far from prime time, and certainly much cruder. But the differences, I think, are illuminating as well as the similarities. Because we view television drama and the violent, the rather overwhelming violent component of it, as part of a system of social control, if you like, part of a system in which people are told about the world they live in, and they're told about it in what has always been, throughout the history of the human race, the most efficient way to explain the way things are. You tell stories, you exemplify it. It's a peculiarity of our culture in the last century, and it's really not much more than the last century, that we have come to believe that we really find out about the way the world works through something called news. That's a rather recent historical notion, that there's something called news which is objective, which simply tells you the facts, no opinion, just the way things are. That in itself, right, becomes a very powerful mechanism for social control, because there is no such thing as just a fact. There is a selection, there is a framing, there is an editing, and if you only have 23 minutes to tell 60, 70 million people the way it is on a given day, you are making many judgments about what is important and what is related to what and how the world works and what the system is. And contrary to, or in addition to, that rather narrow notion of learning about things through the news, we in fact have learned almost everything we know about the world surrounding the news, but not immediately available to us in our everyday lives, from stories, from what, in a kind of official difference, we call fiction. And one way to illustrate that, or just get that point very easily, very quickly, I think, is to think for a moment how clearly how clear your knowledge is, how much you know about any number of important institutions that dominate or make or have important influence on your life, such as law, medicine, business, government. You have a fairly clear image, to use a kind of graphic example, of what happens in a courtroom, of what happens in a jail, or a police station, or an operating room, or a medical conference. All kinds of places you've never been. And the news media haven't really taken you there either. But stories have. Movies, novels, and more television. And you've seen the way these things work. And what you've seen there has informed you in very subtle ways and in very obvious ways about the way the world works. And the people you see doing things inform you about who gets to do them. And the people who have them done to them inform you about who gets done to, as well as who gets to do the doing, which brings us to violence. In the years that we've been studying television violence, it turns out that about 60% of the characters on television are involved in one way or another in violence. It's a continuing feature. The most dramatic finding, in a sense, of 12 years of research on television violence, the most dramatic finding is the lack of change. From a statistical point of view, it's the most significant characteristic of the data on violence is that there is significantly no change. Right? Slight up and down, but altogether no change. And violence, in some ways, is the most dramatic way that television drama explains the rules of the game to people. Right? Because television drama, television violence, shows you who has power and who uses it and what happens when power is used. And television is an efficient way, or stories or drama, are an efficient way to disseminate or enforce social power, because it's much more humane and much more efficient than the actual use of violence. A show of force, as it were, is a much more effective way to maintain control than actually having to go out and use force. Now, The standard concern about television violence or about violence in the media is that the consequence of violence is of viewing violence in the media is committing violence. That you see it and that instigates doing it. Our research and analysis suggests otherwise. It suggests that although in some cases, unarguably, and I think they're fairly isolated cases, violence on television or in the movies may produce imitative violence. If that were the main effect, researchers wouldn't have to be going to the trouble of doing research because the bodies would be piled up around the television sets and in the theater lobbies. The function of the violence is to show you who has power and who can use it. Most violence on television is committed by good guys. That's at least to say the most lethal violence. The pattern of violence in the media over and over again, particularly in television, is that the bad guys, who all too frequently are non-whites, or very young people, or elderly people, or women, when they use violence, which isn't always, they don't always, are not typically shown using violence, but when they are, they're usually transgressors. The bad guys, the transgressors, use violence to hurt the good guys, and then the good guys kill the bad guys. And the lesson that is being taught through a great deal of media violence is that the ruled are not permitted the same things as the rulers. What happens to uppity people is what the message of violence very often is. It says, if you play this game, this is what will happen to you. The other consequence of it, possibly much more important, at least when we're dealing with television, because these movies may be doing something differently because they're aimed at a specific audience, as I think the critics make clear. Those are not aimed at the same audience that television violence is aimed at, which is the 60 to 80 million people who watch network television every night, but a much smaller audience who are going to a very specific product. What the violence is also saying is it's a dangerous world. It's a world in which you're threatened by strangers. It's a world in which certain kinds of people, right, non-whites, young people, maybe women or old people, can be dangerous and can be threatening. And in fact, it's one of the most frequent findings of our research is that people who watch a great deal of television tend to say that the world is more dangerous and they are more threatened by it. And that has consequences, because that leads to the feeling that we need more repressive measures, we need more police, we need more strict laws and punitive sentencing, that we need to fight a guerrilla, we need to fight a defensive war against a kind of violence that may exist much more in the media than it does anywhere else, a certain kind of threat that may exist more in the dramatic stereotypes. So that the media are an instrument of power, and I think it is correct to say that in the case of these films we're talking about, what you see is a very clear backlash. You see an exploitation and a pandering of threat and backlash in somewhat different form than the case of programs on primetime television, and in somewhat different form than some other kind of films. I suspect that those critics who liked Halloween because it was art, right, probably did not have the same objections to the film Looking for Mr. Goodbar that they had to the films that they were talking about. Yet, I would say that Looking for Mr. Goodbar is telling women that promiscuity, or at least non-married sex, gets you killed, right? Just as Dress to Kill did. And just as a film called American Gigolo managed to be rather vicious about gays and women, and if you may recall, the villain who got killed at the end to the audience's satisfaction was a black gay man. Now, after, as I said, many years of looking at this kind of thing and studying it, the question of what judgmental principles can one apply becomes one that I've become fairly concerned with. It's not enough to say that objectivity is a myth and that you're not just telling stories any more than Walter Cronkite is just giving, well, was, Dan Rather, is just giving you the facts. You are always getting a bias. You are always getting a judgment. You are always getting some kind of point of view with some kind of implication. The ethical principles that I would suggest for your consideration, and there are several that I can think of, but there are two that I want to mention as ways of evaluating media product or media material in terms of a judgmental issue. One is that people have the right to speak for themselves. That on the whole, if you're asking, you know, what is good or bad, right, what is better or worse, I am saying that the question should be loaded in favor, the presumption should be loaded in favor of individuals and groups speaking for themselves rather than being spoken for by others. And of course, in our system, almost everyone is spoken for by others, and the others who speak for almost everyone are a reasonably small group of middle-class white males who, at least in public, are heterosexual. And that happens to be a fairly narrow range of the positions or the views or the concerns that are spoken about. So the first question is, who is speaking for whom? And whose point of view is being presented? The second and somewhat more complex ethical principle that I would propose is that given that the media are always a use of power, that is to say, there is no such thing as power irrelevant mass media. The media in themselves are a form of power. Representation on the media is power, and absence from the media, invisibility, is, as Gerbner and I have said, symbolic annihilation. And it is the absence, the symbolic annihilation from the media, that has been a weapon used traditionally against minorities and against women. Blacks, for many years, were invisible in the media. Women are still relatively invisible in the media. The second most consistent finding in our 12 years of television research is that men outnumber women by 3 or 4 to 1, day in and day out, on everything except soap operas and some kinds of commercials. So that invisibility in itself is a lack of power. What happens when you become visible, however, is more complicated than just achieving power by being present. Because groups like women, blacks, and gays, when they begin to become visible, are permitted visibility as long as they are in their place. And their place is that of victim. They can be the victims of violence, and they can be the victims of ridicule. And both have been the avenues through which women, blacks, and gays have been given access to the media. Step and Fetch It, and Lucy, and whatever the nameless numbers, hordes, of swishy men who were allowed to appear on television as long as they adhered to certain kinds of ridiculous stereotypes. The current version, however affectionately framed, is a film called Cage aux Folles. It tells you that gays are exactly what you thought, but they're nice. So the victimization route to presence on television raises the question of how that inevitable power is used. And there I would suggest, again, as an ethical principle or as a principle of judgment, that given that there is always an issue of power, power exercised in favor of those at the bottom of the hierarchy is always morally preferable to power exercised in favor of those who are at the top of the hierarchy. That's to say, if you are asking the question about a particular form of media, is the power that is inevitably here helping those who already have most of the power, or is it in fact helping those who already have almost no power, relatively speaking? Right? Now that's a rather complicated issue, and I want to try and move on and move quickly. We can discuss later, if you like, some examples, because that becomes a rather tricky question, although it may become illuminated in a minute. Right? With those notions in mind, let me ask the question for which, unfortunately, I think I have many fewer answers than about some of these other issues, of what do you do about it? Because if you agree, and I think the clips we saw are hard to argue with, and most of you didn't need those examples in any case, I'm sure, what do you do about it? And I think that it becomes a very, very difficult question to answer. Censorship, I believe, is not an answer. And one reason I believe it's not an answer has to do with who has the power in the society. And giving any opening to censorship, as far as I'm concerned, is a case where you are giving those who already have more power, who already have the power, more of it. Because censorship is a tool in the hands, if it were permitted, is a tool in the hands of the existing power structure. So I don't think censorship gives us an answer. On the other hand, and just as important, there are many forms of protest, and there are many forms of opposition, and there are many forms of combat against the kind of media portrayal that we've seen that are not censorship. And it is every bit as dangerous to allow them to be misrepresented as censorship by the establishment who already hold the power as it is to advocate censorship. When we were fighting the movie cruising and the movie windows, the Motion Picture Manufacturers or Distributors Association took out full-page ads in the New York Times and many other newspapers, spending for one such run of ads considerably more money than the combined budgets of almost every lesbian and gay group in the country, in order to explain to the American people, in case they were confused, that these radical extremists were advocating censorship. What they were advocating was the public's right to make up their own mind. And they had a very nice way of putting this to the public, which is, don't let those people tell you, go and see for yourself, right? Make up your own mind, right? Don't be fooled by these censors. Right? That's a very good argument, right? And I would be perfectly willing to accept it with one provision, that if everyone who went and saw for themselves didn't like it, they'd get their money back. But that's the problem, of course, because once you've gone and seen it and made up your mind, right, they already have your $4 or $5, and you don't get it back. So in fact, you're not exactly just making up your mind for yourself, you're doing what they want, which is supporting them to oppress people and to encourage bigotry. The point that's equally important to make in regard to these debates is that free speech is a very dubious term when we're dealing with the mass media. The term free speech implies, by its very nature, some degree of equality of access. It implies, again, some relative equality of power. But in terms of the mass media, free speech is very expensive. Right? Free enterprise is an expensive business in the mass media. And the classic line on the subject is that of A.J. Liebling, who said years ago, or wrote years ago, that the press is free to the person who owns one. And it's one thing to say that the mass media represent free speech, but films that cost millions of dollars to make, and increasingly in the modern system, even more millions to promote and advertise, are not something that can be countered in any kind of simple free speech. You don't have that kind of access. And keep in mind that protests tend to be centered in a very small number of places, whereas those films tend to open, right, throughout the country. Cruising opened in something like 580 movie theaters around the country. Maybe 80 of them were involved protests. But most of them open in places where there is no ability whatever to present any kind of opposition or any kind of protest. So that I don't think the concern should be, and in fact I think the concern of the opposite should be, to avoid being tarred with the notion of censorship. Secondly, I think quite reasonably you have to use the limited means that are available to those who do not have economic power and do not have access to the media. And it's in many ways a sad reality of politics in the current situation we live in, but it's one that has been learned by various groups for the last 15 or 20 years, is that you have to use the means that are available. And the means that are available tend to be stacked against you. Because in order to let people know that there is an issue, in order to reach some people, and in order to take advantage of one of the small windows that exist in media power, namely the fact that broadcasting something is potentially subversive even if it's not intended as such, that the media often, by broadcasting something, even in their biased way, right, even unintentionally, often give it a degree of diffusion that it otherwise could not get, and simply makes people aware of the fact that things exist that otherwise they simply might not know about, or that there are issues that otherwise might not even appear controversial. When you enter into the realm of sort of media politics, of trying to use the media for political ends, because that's really what the game these things, you are at a great disadvantage, and the odds are stacked against you, but it is one of the few ways to operate. You unfortunately don't get to choose your battles. Okay? The women's movement did not choose to have those films around in order to be able to fight them. You don't get to choose that, right? But it's there. And if it's there, you can't necessarily ignore it. Right? These are battles that you may not be able to win, but you sure can lose. And that, of course, becomes a serious problem. The danger, in part, and it's the danger that I think has to be kept very clearly in mind, is that you can be used also. Is that by fighting against one aspect of a system, you might find yourself in somewhat suspicious alliance with some other aspects of the system that are peculiarly on your side in some of these matters. And the fight against media exploitation of women and the media exploitation of other groups, occasionally, I suspect, will find itself a little bit too uncomfortably close to the moral majority. And I think that the women against pornography in New York might feel a little bit uncomfortable at occupying rent-free offices in Times Square made available by the 42nd Street Redevelopment Corporation, an arm of the upper-class New York City establishment that wants to take a very prime piece of territory around Times Square and turn it into a somewhat more upper-class, somewhat whiter, somewhat cleaner, and somewhat more commercial area. There are very dangerous issues of class bias and race bias, right, that need to be guarded against. And as I'm saying, these are not easy issues, and you really can't avoid them. You don't choose to be there. I mean, no one, the feminist movement didn't say, you know, wouldn't it be nice if all the bad, you know, a lot of these bad films would congregate in 42nd Street, because then we'd know where they were, you know, and we could go and fight them. The factors that bring these things together, right, are, as Marxists have been wont to say, not coincidental. The facts of life in the ghetto tend to be, in most things, a lot starker. The nature of the ghetto is that the rules of power and exploitation, right, are a lot clearer. Low investment, high yield, and brutal power tends to be the defining characteristics of ghettoized situation, and 42nd Street or other places like that are one of them. But you have to understand where that power is and who it is that you're fighting. And how to do it. And there are no easy answers. I think the problem is much larger than any easily available solutions.
I think it's very important for people to be coming together to discuss these questions for which, as Larry said, there are no easy answers, and to try not to shy away from pushing forth into the most complex level of dealing with this, because if we rest easy on some of the simple answers, which appear to be simple, like censorship, I think we do ourselves a great disservice. I'm here today to talk about a number of these issues, to talk briefly about why censorship is not the answer, to talk a bit about how important I think it is that we hold on to an understanding that it is not sexism which arises from pornography, but pornography which arises from sexism, and that therefore to limit our battle at any time, our political battle as feminists, to allow it to become merely today a battle against violence or violent images of women in the media is to, you know, make two mistakes. One, it's to ally ourselves too closely with the moral majority, and second, it is to move away from the very sweeping vision of feminism, which I believe is the only thing which can in fact so deeply change society that these images will go away. I actually think that we ought to throw the word pornography out and stop using it. I don't think it's the right word to describe the problem. Pornography comes from the Greek. And it means, in fact, writing about prostitutes, which is clearly inappropriate definition for the kinds of images that we see. I really think that it would be better for us to talk about images which objectify people, sexual images which are objectifying, as opposed to erotic images. And I'd like to suggest a little bit in my talk today, and I will come to this, about what I think objectification is and what a good definition of that is, and what I think the erotic is. Because I would like to believe that we can be moving towards an erotic culture at the same time that we are moving away from a pornographic one. And I think that that's essential to the feminist vision. The feminist vision is not anti-sexual. And to find a way to affirm sexuality and to affirm sexual rights and to affirm sexual joy while at the same time opposing sexual exploitation is a very tricky matter. Another one of the areas in which there are not easy answers, but something which I feel strongly that we must do. So to be able to really do that, we're going to need something far more complex than censorship could ever achieve. And what we are going to need is nothing less than equality between the sexes. To eliminate pornography and to leave sexual discrimination is not going to get us very far. But if we can eliminate discrimination, we may be able to reduce the amount of pornography as well and lessen its effects without enacting censorship laws themselves. I was going to begin this talk by trying to explain the feminist position, trying to talk about why women are so up in arms today in the women's movement about violence against women. I was going to tell you about rape statistics. I was going to tell you a little bit about the experience in my own hometown, San Francisco, where first we had the Mount Tam killer, and then we had the recent killer in near the Palace of the Legion of Honor, and then we had the police commissioner saying that women shouldn't run, shouldn't go running on Mount Tam area, then they shouldn't go running in groups, and they shouldn't go running alone, then they shouldn't go running in groups. And now we have a situation in which a great runner's town, San Francisco, has essentially said to its women that they can't indulge in the exercise of running. They're too likely to be raped or murdered. Well, I was going to go on and on about some of those things to kind of build the case of why this is a serious matter, but I think that after having seen that film, I will just allude to them. One of the things that's been kind of alarming is the way in which the early debates on this subject polarized very quickly. And, you know, the liberal position up until quite recently has been to say that studies show that violent images do not lead to violent behaviors, that if anything, violent images and sexual images have a cathartic effect, that the man who masturbates to a snuff film is less likely to go out and rape, either because of exhaustion or satisfaction. Feminists have tended to argue almost the opposite position, the position that, on the contrary, what the sexual images do is program men, and that we're now undergoing a kind of a period of massive programming of the male mentality and teaching men essentially to be killers. I don't think enough emphasis has been placed in talking about that programming on some of the things that Larry brought up, which is that programming of fear is perhaps an even wider effect. Today, all you have to do to create a feeling of terror in almost any woman is show an image of a single woman walking down a dark street at night, possibly wearing high-heeled shoes. That's enough for most women to sense that something terrible is about to happen. So I think it can't emphasize too much that one of the fastest effects, one of the most widespread effects of this kind of image of violence is to create a mood of terror. And that we women, I think, are perhaps almost as greatly victimized by the extreme fears that we now have about going out at night, about going running, about walking down the street, that's almost as much of a problem for us in living our lives, you know, to have to carry the burden of this much fear, as it is as anything else you can point to in terms of an actual correlation with real violence. But I do think that the women's movement has backed off the issue of censorship quite a lot, and I want to say that because a few years ago when the movement against violence began, many feminists were strongly for censorship. Today, it's I don't think that we hear that very often, and I think it's because of the election of Ronald Reagan and because of the ascension of the moral majority to power that feminists have gotten the message and liberals have gotten the message very quickly that if we start calling for censorship, it's not we who are going to be the censors. I had a very strong experience of that speaking at the University of Southern California, which is sort of right-wing land, and where Haldeman and Ehrlichman, I think, but at least one of the two, went to college, and a lot of the Nixon cronies. And it's heavy moral majority territory, and I was asked there to be on in a meeting kind of similar to this one, only there I was on the panel with a guy named Ray Gower, who was a lawyer from the moral majority, and a penthouse pet. And that was their balanced panel. I was the feminist. So Ray Gower says, he gets what he says, well, we're going to have a crusade, we're going to close these shops, we're going to end these movies, we're going to clean up these districts, that's valuable property, these are anti-family values. And he said, and I'm glad to have the support of the feminists on this issue. He said, I think they're a little screwed up on some other things, but I'm glad to have their support on this issue. And, I sat there kind of. And then a few minutes later, he was talking about getting the lesbian literature out of the libraries. That went by in a string of other lists of objectives of their crusade. So right away, there goes the alliance. And I think that that's a perception that by now is shared. So I say that because I think that in a way it's a healthy thing for liberals and for the feminist movement to almost be now plunged into having to face the deeper questions and having the all too easy crutch of the hope of censorship really moved out of the realm of discussion, I think, to a great degree. So if you believe strongly in the idea of freedom of expression, if you believe that First Amendment rights should not be abrogated in any way, and yet at the same time you believe that pornography is filled with degrading and violent and sexist images of women, where does that leave you, and what do you do? I think that we need to move away from the classic liberal position, which has been that it leaves you defending the most gross cases. That's been what liberals have had to do in order to stand up for the right to stand up for their belief against censorship. They have all too often found themselves defending pornographers, putting their time, their efforts into defending those rights. We don't have to do that. As Larry said, there's a difference between censorship and protest. It's a mistake to believe that when we protest, we're guilty of censorship. No, we're simply exercising our First Amendment right of free speech, our constitutionally protected right to protest. But more than that, as I keep emphasizing, we have to be in a stage of discussion. We need to be able to talk with one another and talk with the pornographers as well. And I actually believe that can be productive. Playboy and Penthouse magazine have been forced into some interesting positions through this whole debate. The debate has had a real impact on them. And they like to say that they are feminist magazines. They both really do. And they have been asked to sort of show that. And one result was that 2 months ago, Playboy ran a long article on rape in which they came across talking very much as Jean Fischel and Roger Ebert did, saying disassociating themselves completely from those kind of violent images, attacking rapists as sick mental and moral perverts, etc., and sort of drawing a very, and patting themselves on the back, of course, as promoting a healthy kind of liberated sexuality. Now, I may not agree with what Playboy thinks is good, but I do believe that they have been forced into a harder position by these very debates. I do believe that they are being forced into disassociating themselves from certain kinds of criminal activities, which a short period of time ago they wouldn't have done, simply because it might have cost them readership. So I don't think that's insignificant. Maybe in an academic environment, people may feel that talking about what Playboy does is irrelevant, but we should remember that it's one of the largest selling, one of the most influential magazines. And we are in a world today which is divided, for most people, into two different sexual cultures, the culture of the male and the culture of the female, and they have radically different values. The largest selling women's magazines today are magazines like Good Housekeeping and Woman's Day. The largest selling men's magazines are Playboy and Penthouse and so on. So while women, while men are reading pornography, hard or soft, women are reading submission manuals. They're reading magazines which are filled with articles like How to Please Your Man, and for fiction, they're reading romance. They're reading the softest, mushiest, most diffuse, most unsexualized kind of romantic images that you can imagine. Both of these images of sexual relationships, the romantic and the pornographic, I feel are unreal. To some extent, I would say both images are obscene. The man reading his pornography and the woman reading her romance are in a funny way being conditioned to meet each other. He's learning a tough, macho, domineering style, and she's learning passivity and a glorification of the male. They're also being prepared for a gigantic case of performance anxiety on both sides, particularly the male, and the woman is perhaps particularly being groomed for disappointment. It's really true that sex is a terrible experience for an enormously large percentage of sexually active or people who would like to be sexually active people today. And I think that the enormous rise in upsetting, sadistic, violent kind of sexual images that we see today speaks to that, and how can we close our eyes to it much longer? We're talking about the images that Roger Ebert and Jean Fischel talked about were when their analysis that the men in these pictures were sexually frustrated men who hated women, that they were men who regarded independent and free women as somehow opposed to them, taunting them, making them feel inferior. That kind of extreme frustration and rage, that hatred of the opposite sex has got very little to do with an ability to enjoy sex. And that seems to be patently clear. We're in a period of sexual anarchy in this culture. We're in a period in which all of the old sexual methods, the methods, social structures of finding sexual satisfaction or at least handling sexual needs are breaking down. The traditional marriage is breaking down. And the old structure of repressing sexuality is breaking down. And there are very many good things about this process, as well as very many unexpected and disturbing consequences of it. But we women should remember that we were the victims of centuries of sexual repression in a very extreme kind, I think more extreme than that experienced by men. And so I'm coming back to my point that when we are horrified by a release of seemingly psychotic sexual energies, we should remember that we don't want to go back to the old repressive era, the era when women were thought not to have any sexual desires at all. And in the 19th century, women were considered pathological, literally pathological, by mainstream medicine. And this was what was taught in the medical schools at Yale and Harvard and everywhere else. Women were considered physically, mentally, and morally sick if they had sexual desires. And as late as 1957, a widely read gynecological textbook recommended for women who failed to achieve orgasm that they find a way of faking it. And it was mainstream, it was common for marriage manuals to say that sexual satisfaction was not important for the female, but only for the male. So we're in a strange kind of period of time, you know, when an old repressive ethic is being cast off, and optimistically put, we're in a period of experimentation socially. We're in a period of experimentation with new forms of sexual experience. But we need to remember that a period of experimentation is necessarily also a period of what is often called by sociologists deviance. What was considered deviant is what is experimented with in a period when one sexual paradigm is breaking down and another one is arising. And so it becomes a time to test our definitions of deviance, to try to open up our minds and say, well, what is deviance? Is this deviant? Is there anything, if it's unusual, is there anything wrong with it? And if so, why and what? Homosexuality is a very good example of this. Homosexuality is something that was considered, as we all know, completely pathological only a short period of time ago. Now we're finding the American medical and psychiatric professions changing their minds radically about this. So to some extent, I think that a society has to tolerate, has to have an ability to tolerate the new, has to have an ability to tolerate the violation of taboos, an ability to tolerate people doing things that are shocking and upsetting, and be able to question whether that's something that can be integrated into a more wholesome society as a whole, or whether it isn't. So to come then to what I've been using the word pornography, and that's because I didn't define objectification and erotica yet, and now I'll come back around to that and say that I'll be able to stop using the word pornography in a moment and suggest that we think of these two terms. Objectification, I believe, could be defined as relationships in which one person serves the needs of the other, and the one person is in the scene, in the picture, or in the relationship, from the point of view of the subject, primarily so that the subject can gratify their own desires. Erotica, I would like to define as sexual representations which include a concept of mutuality. Ideally, these are images or relationships in which there is a kind of a transcendence which takes place, in which the pleasure of the partner is as important to what is going on as the pleasure of the subject. And that's true on both sides. With that definition of erotica, is really close to being a definition of sexualized love, but in its most ideal form. But I'm not equating erotica and love. I'm talking about a relationship which includes an ideal of equality, an ideal that the pleasure of the experience is one which is shared. The pleasure of the partner is as important to the totality as the pleasure of the self. In objectification, the opposite is the case. I think that's a kind of definition which gets us away from something as vague as writing about prostitutes or simply, you know, the display of sexual materials, which is the way people are defining pornography. I do think these matters of point of view are key. And actually, I thought that Roger Ebert in the film made a good point about Halloween, and that that aside from what was said about art redeeming, which I don't agree with, one of the two men said that What was key about that scene was the difference in perspective, the film being shown from the perspective of the victim as opposed to the film being seen from the perspective of the killer. I think that kind of thing is so important, so little talked about and so important. And I'd like to see us find definitions that help us to talk about matters like that. And I hope that talking about objectification and talking about erotica will help us to look at the sexist content rather than the sexual content alone. I want to end just by saying that it's pretty well known among professional sexologists and marriage counselors and so on, even though I have many criticisms of much of their work, I do think that their research has tended to prove what everybody ought to know anyway, which is that good sex is very much based on equality. Good sex is very much based on mutual respect. Good sex cannot take place without communication, equal communication. If you're talking about an erotic experience or an erotic representation, the partner, the pleasure, the experience of each partner has to be as big, as important, count as much as the pleasure or the experience of the other. That means equality. So I strongly believe that sexual equality is part and parcel of sexual joy and sexual fulfillment, that it is precisely the women's liberation movement which will tend to lead to a more sexually fulfilled, a more eroticized culture. And I would like to believe that with women's liberation, with the advent of an egalitarian society, pornography would simply wither away.